I'm Frank Vaughn. It is April 22nd, 2025, and we're going to continue our examination of Mark Carney's book today. First, I just want to highlight, however, that all is not what it seems in provincial politics either. This is Alberta Premier Daniel Smith hires a corrupt, woke, big pharma psychopath as new chief medical officer of health, reads the headline. Maybe I wouldn't word it that way, but this is the guy, Dr. Sunil Sukram. To understand who he is, you just have to read his history. We need a real vaccine passport in Alberta, one that can't be forged, one that is mandated everywhere. No healthcare worker should be unimmunized. No more excuses. Huge congratulations to Amarjeet Sohi and Jyoti Gondek as the newly elected mayors of Edmonton and Calgary. These cities can look forward to continued progressive, inclusive leadership for years to come. What is Daniel Smith doing? So many mixed signals coming out of Alberta. But let's get back to the task at hand, which is Mark Carney's book. The point I want to make opening that way is that the shadow of COVID still hangs large over everything. The same people are in the same positions in many provinces across this federation. And we're going to, as we explore Mark Carney's book, we're going to encounter COVID over and over and over again. But let's just begin from the top. The quote is, as we shall see, values of trust, integrity, and fairness are critical to effective market functioning. They should not be assumed or taken for granted. Society's practices, mores, and values are established and reinforced by a process of mutual sympathies. Social capital needs to be nurtured for economic capital to grow. The argument being that your mores, your values, your morals compose your social capital, and that is the base upon which markets grow and thrive. Now, he says down here, whatever its broader merits, if it is allowed to dominate, subjective value theory could sow the seeds of its demise by turning moral sentiments into market sentiments. Now, what you're going to see in this book is Carney's concerned with imposing moral sentiments, ideological sentiments upon the operating market. So this is where the inherent contradictions that pollute this book, where he says one thing in one chapter and says another in another chapter. It's not just Orwellian doublespeak, it's direct contradiction. This is how you know that this man has no center. His center is money. His center is profit-making, rent-seeking, even though he casts aspersions at both of those ideas, as you'll see. Further to this idea, here is a quote, the tacit social contract has also been loosened in a hyper-capitalist, globalized world because individuals are unmoored from their social settings. Our actions are no longer monitored by the people amongst whom we live. People live in one place and work in another. The citizens of nowhere haven't been transcending their polity to rise to the level of humanity, but detaching from it and atomizing into themselves. It is possible that the COVID-driven location restrictions will reestablish some sense of community among the formerly footloose. So the idea here is that the sense of local community has diminished and that somehow lockdowns and mandates will reawaken it. People were locked in their houses. They were forbidden from seeing their neighbors. They were arrested for having social gatherings. They're elderly. Family members were left alone to die in old age homes. It broke local community. It broke family. It divided the unvaccinated from the vaccinated. It divided the paranoid from the reasonable. It divided those who could see from those who couldn't see and empowered those who couldn't see. And in his bizarre twist, he thinks that actually equates to community building. But a further quote, just a little ways down, is tech companies repeat the mantra of paying all the taxes that are due while inventing sham companies to abrogate their fiscal responsibilities in the countries where they are most active and make their greatest profits. He writes criticisms of capitalism, of big business, avoiding taxation. What does he think Brookfield does? They do this exact thing. Again, highlighting what I introduced yesterday, which is Marx seems to be engaging in a form of self-hatred. He's railing against his own fundamental nature. He is philosophizing about restoration of humanity and morals and ethics to capital markets, while at the same time justifying central banks' ultimate power, at the same time as engaging in the very activities which he claims to be against. Another section from page 122. Yet when the means, money, become the ends, society suffers. Marx saw greed as a stage of social development. In other words, it was neither intrinsic nor natural. Money is an accelerant, giving greed an abstract hedonism because the pursuit of its accumulation possesses all pleasures in potentiality. Quoting Marx, greed itself is reinforced by the commodification of life as there is more and more that money can buy. Not only is this a hypocritical criticism of the pursuit of money, which is all Brookfield does, central banking, banking and finance, which he doesn't talk about tradespeople in this book. He doesn't talk about construction workers in this book. He talks about public officials, finance, banking, big money. That's how he thinks in terms of what moves the real world. And in a sense, he's right, because they control the game. They control the issuance of currency. They control who has and who has not. But what kind of a character, what kind of a psychology lies behind an individual who's spent his entire life in the pursuit and dedication to and of money, and he sits here quoting Marx, condemning money itself, the pursuit of money. And it doesn't seem to be just limited to money. It's the very act of pricing things. He's criticizing the very capitalism that has enabled him to do all the things that he's done with his life. Again, a form of self-hatred. Another quote, to be inclusive, economic institutions must include secure private property, an unbiased system of law, and the public services that provide a level playing field in which people can exchange and contract. Now, he doesn't mention Canada very much other than as his role as governor of the Bank of Canada, which he discusses in a limited way in the book, except in the inserted sections that came sometime after the Russian intervention in Ukraine. I'm still not sure when those insertions were made, but those insertions were made to talk specifically about Canada sometime in 2022 or 2023, almost as a prelude to his run for prime minister. Coincidences are piling up everywhere. But this quote is an artifact because you don't have secure private property here in Canada. As we've highlighted in other videos, there are no private property rights recognized in the Constitution or the Charter, and they were deliberately left out by Trudeau at the request of the NDP back in the early 1980s when this was all designed. He talks about an unbiased system of law. How can you have an unbiased system of law that empowers central banking to just issue currency whenever they need and hand it directly to banks who have rendered themselves insolvent? We'll come back to that. We're going to circle around to that a bunch of times as we pursue exploration of this book. But the rules of the game are deliberately rigged towards the World Economic Forum, towards these supranational organizations, and the global banking and finance system. So you don't have an unbiased system of law when absolute power rests in the hands of individuals who aren't even elected. And he mentions the public services providing a level playing field. The public services are an extension of that unfair law. So all three factors that he says you need to be in to have inclusive economic institutions are absent. But he is not talking about their absence. He's talking about their presence. Another section that indicates his love of banking. In fractional reserve banking, banks take deposits but keep only a fraction of their assets in gold, cash, and liquid securities, with the balance used to fund loans and investments. This improves the efficiency of the financial system in that a well-run bank can extend credit to businesses and households on a scale that can be multiples of its loss-absorbing capital. If concerns about a bank's solvency emerge, however, depositors can withdraw more funds than the bank actually has, not least because its loans cannot be immediately called in. They aren't liquid. Repeated crystallizations of this vulnerability over the centuries would eventually prompt the creation of both institutions of public oversight of private money, like banking supervision, and public safety nets, like depositor insurance, and the central bank's core role as lenders of last resort. The subtitle is Public Institution and Values Ultimately Underwrite Money. Over the centuries, central banks have developed this critical role as lenders of last resort to backstop solvent banks against such liquidity crisis. So the bank doesn't keep on hand enough cash to satisfy the withdrawals of the depositors. If too many people come in and try and get their money, it will crash the bank. In Carney's mind, that bank is still solvent. In Carney's mind, fractional reserve lending is a godsend. And the central banks have to be there to print money out of thin air to provide liquidity. Liquidity is cash. To satisfy depositors withdrawing money if they run the bank. However, when the central bank prints that money, the money the depositors are trying to get out becomes worthless. It has less value. It can buy less things because the money supply is being inflated. This is all business as usual to Carney. There's nothing wrong with this. But at the same time, he attacks capitalism, he attacks money, and he attacks the very pricing of things while quoting Marx. Do you understand what this man represents? In answer, it's not just that he's a not-so-closeted Marxist. It's that he engages in the very behaviors he condemns, which means he has no center. It explains why he talks about morality and humanity and ethics in terms like a fish describing being a primate. They're foreign concepts because he has no center. Another quote, the social contract comprising relative equality of outcomes, absolute equality of opportunity, and intergenerational equity seeks to maximize social well-being. These are not the statements of an economist. These are the statements of a Marxist. Another quote, in moving from a market economy to a market society, are we consuming the social capital necessary to create economic and human capital? I am constantly reminded of Lenin. So maybe Marxism isn't the right reference. Maybe Leninism is, even though he doesn't quote Lenin, he quotes Marx. The entire time I was reading this book, and I read it intensively, I didn't just read it, I studied it, I was reminded of reading Lenin 20, 30 years ago when I did a deep dive on Lenin. The language is very similar. And while he uses all of this socialist social justice verbiage, in the book opens with him describing the gilded halls of wealth that he walks in. And you can tell that he has a reverence for the contents of the Bank of England. And in spite of him being angry or calling gold a relic, even though it's pursuing all-time highs right now, which should, right off the hop, you should question everything. He calls the $180 billion in gold in the Bank of England's vaults a relic of a former era, completely futile. Yet there it sits, and those central banks are buying more of it, and right now the market is buying so much of it, that gold is at an all-time high and might just be at the start of its run. The RSI is off the chart, but I digress. He describes in his book his relations with the most powerful people on this planet, the richest people on this planet. A quote, I first encountered him at a breakfast of the G7 deputies while attending the IMF World Bank annual meetings in Dubai in the fall of 2003. That's how far back his history goes as a oligarchical leader. This group styled themselves as the informal steering committee of the global economy, heirs to the architects of the Louvre and Plaza Exchange Rate Accords in the 1980s. He LARPs, live-action role plays, as the champion of the people. He has no clue who the people even are. Like most politicians and leaders who talk about the people and representing the people and equity and justice, they have no idea why the people even need to hear that conversation. It's central banking and governments who have put the people in the positions that they are in. He talks about this. First is the famous case of a daycare center in Israel, where it was decided to introduce fines for parents who were picking up their children late and inconveniencing the daycare staff who had to stay late. In response, the incidence of late pickups rose sharply. The fine was viewed as a fee, removing the social stigma of making teachers wait. Instead, parents were covering the cost and optimized their time accordingly. So we're talking about a daycare center. He then uses the term teacher interchangeably with daycare staff. I've already talked about how daycare staff are not concerned with teaching your children. They won't even push them on a swing. Like I've said, I've seen them in parks. They're attached to their phones. They're not paying attention to the kids. The kids are desperate for attention and they can't get it. And why can't they get it? Because their parents are off working to pay taxes. So they work their lives away, trading away the most precious commodity they will ever possess, which is the childhood that they're missing with their kids, the presence of their own children, the most wonderful love you will ever experience as a good soul on this planet. They have to go work to pay taxes so that they can then pay for subsidized daycare, which employs and advertises itself as cheap, the cheapest option. So all of your money is going to the banks to pay their interest rates on your mortgage. All of your money is going towards taxation. And a little tiny bit of your money is going to this subsidized daycare where your kids are in an attention deficit. And he would judge, because this is an ongoing situation, if the parents have no time, they might be encouraged to leave their kids late, pay a fee so that they can do something else with their time, likely seek more money. And the impact on the daycare staff being stuck with your kids that they and the daycare staff don't want to be stuck there. They have lives of their own. They're at the daycare working so that they too can pay taxes. The entire situation, and this is the only point of relevance, is the result of expansive government and the inherent unfairness of the system of finance and banking that we all live under. Nowhere does that factor in to this man's thinking. But he does have something that he blames for all of society's ills. The issue extends and goes deeper by affecting values themselves. Altruism, generosity, solidarity, and civic spirit are not like commodities with fixed supplies that are depleted with use. In contrast, they grow stronger with exercise. Alternatively, by shrinking the social space and expanding the reach of the market into the heart of what had been family life, the market undercuts community, atomizes the family, and affects mental health by turning more of life into a scorecard competition. The market, according to him, does that. The market, which doesn't have a power to tax. The market, which doesn't have the power to create money out of nothing. The market, which doesn't have the power to regulate you and take your freedom away. To him, the market does this. It's the government. It's the system itself that undercuts community, that divided you against yourselves during COVID-19. It's the government that has cut the family apart and created a tax burden so high and created inflation that is so endemic that you have to go work and be a tax slave and give your kids away to someone else to raise. It's the government that created these circumstances, not the market. But in Carney's mind, it's the market itself. It's capitalism. It's the exchange. Not the people who define the exchange, but the exchange itself that's at the heart of the problem. These dynamics, another quote, have led to a series of crises of value that will be explored in part two. The crisis of finance, health, climate, and identity are not merely the product of shortcomings in the ability of markets to value. They are also the result of how the encroachment of the market has changed our values, not the encroachment of government, not the encroachment of central banking, sinking its tentacles into the entire world, not the top-down technocratic socialism of these individuals who has had, it's not even far more, the totality of the change of society, this degradation of the family and community is entirely the responsibility of the system, not the market. In spite of the fact that he comes from an industry If you can call finance an industry, if you can call central banking an industry, which values merit, you as a dropout from high school aren't going to get a job at a central bank. Maybe you'll get a job sweeping the floor, but that's probably out of reach for you as well. You require a very expensive education to even be considered a bank employee. Richard Layard bemoans the increasing prevalence of the testing of children and the ranking of education and health professionals. These are approaches that make success personal and individualistic rather than the result of improving the happiness and welfare of others. Evidence suggests that it breeds stress and dissatisfaction even among the winners. So testing an individual merit equaling reward is a net negative in Mark Carney's mind. It should be about the all and not the individual. Equality of access, equality of outcome, and not individual merit. However, at the same time as he pens this criticism, this is a man that talks about tracking every individual's carbon budget. And we'll see that as we delve deeper into this book, that he is obsessed with rating people, rating companies, rating governments, penalizing them based on those ratings. He's all about meritocracy when it comes to his ideology. But here, he defames and casts aspersions on meritocracy itself. This is a theme that you should be seeing developing over and over again. He has no actual principled center. He talks about principles, he talks about morals and ethics, but he himself doesn't actually have an anchor in any of those things. He's talking about foreign concepts, and it comes through loud and clear in this book. Another section from the book, if markets move sharply away from a range that seems appropriate, the policymakers must humbly admit that there must be something they are missing that causes the market in its infinite wisdom to behave the way it does. But as Tommaso observed, when we grant an entity infinite wisdom, we enter the realm of faith. Faith can guide life, but blind policy. This exchange took place during a time when the mindsets of public policymakers had fully absorbed pro-market radicalism in academia. In the discourse of political leaders and in patterns of social life where industry and private finance were held up as masters of the universe. Again, an interesting thing. His idea is that central banking and banking are independent, though loosely accountable to government. He claims they're accountable to government. They're not. Independence implies that they are not accountable. Has any central banker gone to jail? Do they do anything but the bidding of politicians and private finance? He holds them up. He holds central banking up as the ultimate bedrock of moral action in the markets. He has no words of criticism other than saying very mildly that they have made mistakes, but he doesn't detail those mistakes. He doesn't talk about, or doesn't spend very much time anyway, talking about crashes, booms, and busts, and the things that the central banks got wrong. They're always innocent victims of the market. The market, capitalism itself, is the enemy in Mark Carney's mind. He says that faith can guide life, but blind policy. But he has nothing but faith in central banking. He criticizes the market. He criticizes money. He criticizes capital. But this is a man whose entire career has been dedicated to wielding the power of those things and as a regulator, bending those regulations to the advantage and to the betterment of private finances' bottom line. He calls illiquid banks solvent. He justifies $15 trillion in taxpayer-backed bailouts handed to his buddies in finance. And at the same time, he can write all of these things. It's not so much the policies and the ideas that he's espousing. It's the fact that he can suck and blow at the same time. Have you ever tried to breathe in and breathe out at the exact same time? Use one lung to inhale and one lung to exhale? You're going to fail, and it's going to lead to failure. But purely financial remuneration ignores the non-pecuniary value of employment, such as satisfaction from helping a client or colleague succeed. This reductionist view of the human condition is a poor foundation for ethical financial institutions needed to support long-term prosperity. The global financial crisis was as much a crisis of culture as of capital. And this is a mild introduction to the theme, which is that central banks and regulators must intervene in the markets to dictate where the market can go. The market's too free. The market's too liberated. It must be reined in and it must be steered. You'll find in later chapters, as I'm sure I've highlighted as we move through this, that he wants regulators to get involved in creation of markets, which is the government mandates a market must exist in the pursuit of their ideological ends, and then they're just going to rely on something that Mark Carney calls divine coincidence to make things work. He recognizes that public money is limited, that governments alone can't get the job done, so that private money, private capital, must be harnessed to advance the ideological agenda. And you do that by forcing that advancement from the institutions, from on high, from the institutions that he has placed his faith in. The very same faith that he says blinds policy is the same faith that he wants to use to craft policy. A quote from the book, "Conversely, the spread of the market undermines community, which is one of the most important determinants of happiness. When we outsource civic virtues to paid third-party providers, we narrow the scope of society and encourage people to withdraw from it. The market undermines community. The free exchange between one party and another." One of my greatest experiences in life that taught me so much, far more than any school could ever teach me, was running a stall at a farmer's market. That alone would have been great, but I also ran the farmer's market, and that taught me a lot about politics and nature and how it scales up and downs, how people are the same, and circumstances, political circumstances, scale up and scale down. A skill set learned at the bottom can be applied at the top, but I digress. Meeting with people, having face-to-face conversations, having free exchange, that built community. We did concerts for kids. We did fundraisers for local charities. Every single market day for 4 hours, hundreds of people would come up and we would interact face-to-face. There was nothing evil about the market. He blames, if you substitute the word market for government or central banking or the regulators or the people who overlord over you, you might have a far more accurate book. His blame is cast in the absolute wrong direction, and it's probably because he's read too much Marx, who he invokes over 30 times in this book, far more than any other philosopher. He can't help himself. He's got to bring Marx back into the conversation constantly. In this section, he talks about some problems, some profound changes that we're about to face the world. North Korea launched its first nuclear test. The Scottish National Party won its first Scottish election. And a panel of international scientists suggested that global warming might be man-made. His obsession with climate change we'll get to in short order. But it's the SNP winning the Scottish election, the idea of Scottish independence. Carney hates nationalism. He actually, later on, you'll see, because I've highlighted it, he talks about the necessity of patriotism, but the evil of nationalism. He got involved in Brexit when he was supposed to be sitting atop a central bank that was not political. He forecasted doom and gloom for the British if they voted for Brexit. And things might not be great in Britain, but it's not because of Brexit. It's because of the money printing. It's because of mass immigration. It's because of their assault on speech. The evils of the world have nothing to do with the causes that I was about to say Marx Carney, that Mark Carney identifies. As we will find out in subsequent parts of this series, because I think I'm going to continue this every single day this week, and maybe through the weekend until Election Day, Monday. I don't know what to think about the election. I have a bad feeling about it all. I think people should get out and vote to stop this man. For all the people complaining and whining about the Conservative Party being exactly the same, I've highlighted on this channel that there are several key differences, and one of the biggest key differences is Polyev is not Mark Carney. He does not have his background. He didn't write this book. Then come back tomorrow. This is a quote. Trichet's colleague didn't wait, but went straight back to Frankfurt to join the ECB's initiative, unprecedented at the time, to pump billions of euros in liquidity into their money markets because he sensed that by tomorrow, all would have been lost. Again, pumping billions of euros in liquidity. That means creating money out of thin air and dumping it on the market so that people can transact. In the act of doing so, the market continues to move, but the value of everyone's money is in decline. It favors the rich. It creates this idea of too big to fail. It's so interesting to me that Carney can defame capitalism, defame markets, but at the same time defend the preservation and the work that's done on behalf of the biggest players and the richest people, the oligarchs. He does them at the same time. And this should be a warning for everybody. Now, to finish up this edition, because I have to go do an interview on, I can't even remember the guy's name. Apparently he's got a podcast following that's in the six figures, so we'll go and we'll talk to him. I usually go into interviews blind. I don't do a ton of background research. I just want to go in, and whatever they throw at me, I'll respond to in real time. I figure that creates a much more authentic response. Puts me on the spot. I like being on the spot. So I have to go and do that, and I want to get this uploaded and have the ability to put it out. But Carney also views, and we will find out this week, that populism is the great enemy of society. It shouldn't be surprising after all the things that we've heard. Now, populism, at its base, is people-centric politics. It's what people want. And the idea that Mark Carney espouses is that the people don't know what's good for them, so the technocrats have to do it for them. They have to rule over the people because the people are too stupid and profane to actually properly represent themselves. This is the man we are on the cusp of handing the nation over to. This is a man whose entire career has been about breaking people down, picking up distressed assets, and generating profit for the wealthiest people in society. He is not a populist champion. He can't be because he hates populism. He is not a man of the people. He's an out-of-touch economist, a globalist, an oligarchical collectivist who views his role as ruling over you. And he dares call that role humble. He dares to say that he engages humility. There's no humility in this book. This is a top-down book. This is an examination and an attempt to understand what the word humble means from somebody who has no concept of it. So stay tuned for the next part. I'm Frank Vaughn. If you like this work, please consider financially supporting it so that I can keep it going into the future. Did you know that I have a website? FrankVaughn.ca, the ultimate repository for all of my work, and a backup location just in case the censors come for me again. And if you like the content, please consider using the donate link and one of the options available. There are no paywalls, there is no advertising, and there is no Patreon, and I intend to keep it that way. Thank you for your time and your consideration.